Hi, I'm Jennifer, and I'm a member of Stevensville Alateen Group.
Hi, Jennifer.
I'm a sophomore in high school and have been in Alateen for 3 years. Today, I'm going to discuss my recovery and how I got there. I hope you will get what you're looking for out of what I have to say. Before I begin to tell you about how the program has worked and is working in my life, I think I should briefly mention what it was like before I started Alateen, although I'm sure you already all know how most of that goes. I think my mom has been drinking for a long time because I remember when she would go to the town bar when I was little. But I don't think I really realized the fact that she was drinking and that it was a problem until the latter part of my sixth grade year. I think back and remember many terrible nights in that house. In seventh and eighth grade, it was just about the same, except there were a couple different added problems, her boyfriends. I really can't remember how I dealt with this. I remember making her feel guilty every time she went out. I also know that I, too, felt guilty for her drinking and for the fact that she needed boyfriends. I felt that I was the only person in the world who had these problems because most of my friends had good families. Because of this, I never had any of my friends over. I always went to their house. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed being in a real family situation. I was a very closed-up person. I still am, but not quite as much. And I didn't talk to many people about what went on at my house. I felt no one would understand. I felt that people would think less of me because of my mom's drinking. There was one main person I did talk to, though. It was and is my band director, Mr. Gary Gillette. He changed my life, and I will never forget him. In about the middle of my eighth grade year, he told me about Alateen and asked me to consider joining. He requested for me to go into the high school group, so I had to meet with the sponsor first. I was scared stiff. I hardly said a word, but I listened very intently. The word alcoholic kept repeating in my mind. I thought, I can't really say that my mom is an alcoholic. That's mean. She just has a problem. Maybe. Well, I went to my first meeting, again scared stiff. I was sweating golf balls throughout the entire meeting. I hardly said a word, but what I found there, love, concern, you know the rest, I liked it. I kept going back. I learned that alcoholism was a disease and that everyone in the family was affected by it. I learned that it's not my fault for her drinking and that people will like me just the same whether I have an alcoholic mom or not. But most important, I learned about how they used a higher power. I feel that I have been close to the Lord for a long time, although I have grown a lot since then. But I think self-consciously, the program has helped me grow closer to the Lord by always talking about a higher power. God is very important in my life and has helped a lot with the program and all. My most favorite thing that I have gotten out of the program is the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity. Tells me to be calm about the whole ordeal. Take it with ease. To accept the things I cannot change helps to remind me that I cannot change anyone but myself. Courage to change the things I can gives me reassurance when I'm in the process of changing. And the wisdom to know the difference helps me to think about my projects before I go head on into them without considering the consequences, or benefits for that matter. I would have to say that the most important part of that prayer is the verse telling me to accept the things I cannot change. I guess I've always hoped that I could change my mom's drinking habits, but haven't we all? With the program and the Serenity Prayer, though, I've learned that the only person I can change is me. This I have done. I've learned to accept her drinking, to accept her for who she is and love her anyway. I've come to the point now where her drinking doesn't bother me as much as it used to. In fact, she has cut down immensely. She, too, has learned from what I tell her and from what she sees in her boyfriend, who has been living with us for 2 years, and her friends that drink. I am very proud of her. I feel that we have grown closer in the past couple of years. We are able to communicate more easily, although we still don't communicate as much as I would like to. I think the program has helped with this. As you probably noticed, I have a lot of I thinks and self-consciously in here. Well, I must admit that I don't work the program as well as I should and would like to. I never catch myself consciously focusing on the steps or slogans. I'm sort of ashamed of that because these are wonderful things that should be a part of everyone's life. That's why I say self-consciously for many things. I feel that in the very back of my mind lie the steps and the slogans that are for me, and when I need them, I use them. You might say that I've adapted the steps and slogans for me in my own way. One of my goals in the Alateen program is to learn more about each and every step and slogan and consciously apply them to my life, the way they are needed. I have many other goals in Alateen for myself, and I've got a long way to go before I accomplish them. Right now, I am just in the process of recovery. In fact, I don't know if I'll ever fully recover, or if any of us will, because the scars and characteristics will always be there. If any of you have never been to Alateen, or have only been going for a short time, or are thinking about quitting, I will make one big suggestion to you. It's a great place to go, and I think you should continue on through Alateen and later on to Al-Anon. Just to be honest with you for a moment, I'm not sure if I'll do that, but I suggest it. I guess as I'm encouraging you, I'm also encouraging myself. Before I conclude, because this is real short here, as I've been going through the different things since I've been here Friday night, I thought of a lot of different things I could say when I got here, but they aren't written down, so I kind of have to fumble my way through them. But one thing that I want to tell the people of Alateen, for some people, the alcoholic home isn't quite as hard as it is for others. And I thought to myself, often in the Alateen program, I shouldn't be here. I don't have half as big a problem as she does. I mean, why should they be bothered with my problems? But I've been encouraged by my sponsor and our counselor that no matter how big your problem is, it doesn't matter because it still affects you and hurts you. That's one thing I want to say. And before I came here, it was hard because I had to tell people that didn't know that I was here, that I came to Alateen, that I was coming here and what it was. And that was hard for me. But through the help of the program, I accomplished that very well. And I just want to encourage everybody that has a loved one who's an alcoholic or a parent who's an alcoholic, that Alateen is a place for you and for everybody. I want to thank all of you for having me speak today, and I hope you got what you were looking for. Good luck to each and every one of you in the future. I'd like to please let us end by saying the Serenity Prayer together, even though we already said it. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Thank you.
Ask Blanche to speak to us. I heard her 2 years ago in Boise. I fell in love. I'd say it, but I think my husband did too, and I brought the tape home. But anyway, I'm used to those kind of things, though. You know how it goes. But I would like very much... Well, you've all seen that big dude in the black hat running around crazy selling tickets. I belong to him. May I at this time introduce you to Blanche.
My name is Blanche. I am a grateful recovering member of Al-Anon. Hi.
Hi, Blanche.
Thank you, Dick. And I have been a member of the Al-Anon family groups since July 7th, 1964. 22 years makes me a survivor, not a savior. And I say that for my sake as well as yours, because I need to remember it. I would be remiss in my good manners if I did not thank the committee for the invitation to your roundup. I have appreciated the flowers and the food and the accommodations and the warmth and the hospitality. I try to never to talk without thanking the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who have so generously shared with us their program of recovery as they so generously shared with us their illness. This is my first time to talk in Montana, and now I was beginning to think you were avoiding me on purpose. I've been a whole lot of places and been allowed to share Al-Anon, and I am so glad to be here in this beautiful, magnificent state. I've decided that those of you who live here must like it because I never meet anybody from Montana anywhere else. Everyone else is moving to Texas. The entire Midwest, it seems to us, has just emptied into Texas over the last 5 or 10 years. Sometimes we think we've been guarding the wrong river. You know, we should have been guarding that one to the north. It was beautiful flying in. You have meadows full of wildflowers, as Texas does, and that isn't true everywhere. And I love the spectacular scenery, but even more, I love the free and easy and comfortable atmosphere here. So I do thank you. For the last few years, oh, maybe 10 now, I have been trying, when I have been allowed to share Al-Anon in other places, to talk from my heart instead of my head. Now, this requires me to be very vulnerable and to take a lot of emotional risks with you. But I know that that which does not come from the heart does not reach the heart. And I very much want to reach your hearts this afternoon, so I will ask you to listen to me with your hearts while I'm talking. See, for years I could talk about the program, but not about me. I lecture very well. And a lot of people can't tell the difference who are listening, but I could tell the difference because it wasn't contributing to my therapy, and that's what sharing is supposed to do. And so I have been trying, and I do it a little better all the time. I'm taking a few more risks all the time to tell you how I feel instead of just what I think. And I will need you loving me back while I do that. I am here to participate in your roundup, not to perform. A number of you have said that you've heard me talk somewhere else or you've heard a tape, and I always tell those people that they could have had a nap this afternoon because I have just one story. I'm not going to go out and do it over again, so I'll have something different to tell you. If the stories ever are the same. I don't know where we were, you and I, if we have met before. I don't know where we were on our spiritual journey, but at a different place from where we are today. I have done a great deal of hurting and rejoicing and loving and learning over the last few years, and I dare say you have too. And so we really aren't the same. I came into Al-Anon kicking and screaming and clutching my halo and protesting to everyone who would listen and to a lot of people who weren't interested at all that I was fine, thank you. You know, I wrapped my robes of righteousness about me and I told them that I had not done the drinking and I did not need the therapy. Thank you very much. God led me to a group of people who were serious about recovery. And what I know about the principles of Al-Anon today, I know because they were practiced lovingly and tenderly on me. Not because I read them and not because someone recited them to me, but because they practiced these principles on me. They loved me when I was unlovable. And they tolerated me when my behavior was just well nigh intolerable. I was condescending and I was patronizing and they loved me anyway. And I found out that this was not a ladies' auxiliary, nor a sewing circle, nor a coffee klatch, but a group of people who were serious about recovery and who wanted to get well. I usually stop here in my story and try to clear up a few misconceptions, and I imagine you have them in Montana. I run across them nearly everywhere. I used to say I was a typical Al-Anon when I got to you. I've quit saying that because that brings different pictures to different minds. And I'm not sure what your idea of a typical Al-Anon is. I try to dispel a few rumors, too. One rumor, and I'll bet you've heard it, is that all alcoholics, without exception, are either handsome or beautiful, talented, sensitive, charming, intelligent, and sexy. Have you heard that one? I never get any argument on that. But the other side of that coin is that they are inevitably married to dull, mousy people. And if that's your idea of a typical Al-Anon, you can forget it. Please don't believe my AA friends in California who say that there is a foolproof way to tell a member of Al-Anon from a member of AA that a member of AA has multiple personalities and an Al-Anon has one or less. I am allowed to tell Al-Anon jokes. It is not true that Al-Anons make love with their eyes closed because they can't bear to see an alcoholic have a good time. You're a great audience. And another myth, I think, that's prevalent is that the non-alcoholic stayed home knitting, you know, Priscilla Pureheart, while the alcoholic did his thing during the drinking years. And some of us did, but some of us did the same things the alcoholic did, and we did them cold sober. So I think it's important that we not have any illusions about each other this afternoon. It comes out a little later in my story that for 22 years I was a high school English teacher. It will not surprise you that I want to define our terms. So just to keep the record straight, some well-meaning members of AA, and I think they truly do not know any better, refer to any member of their family as an Al-Anon. That's like referring to a still-drinking alcoholic as a member of AA. An Al-Anon is a member of an Al-Anon family group who attends meetings regularly and who works the program. And I thought maybe Texas wasn't the only place where that happens. If you hear anyone else talking about Al-Anon, don't pay any attention. That person is uninformed. People like that are not carrying the message. They are spreading the disease. I learned some things that Al-Anon is not, and that it is not coffee makers and cookie bakers, and above all, we are not AA groupies. Al-Anon is not a therapeutic tool for the treatment of alcoholism. It does not promise to save marriages, only sanity. And when I got to you, I thought both of those were in pretty good shape. At my house, I lived to learn better than that. But I know now that happily ever after may not mean walking hand in hand into the sunset. Happily ever after is my personal recovery. And that's what you promised me. This program is for me. An analogy I like to use is my mother's death. She died in 1965. I had been with you for a year. I loved her beyond anyone else in the world. She was 58, which isn't young, but it's young to die, and I thought I could not stand it. And the last time I visited her, she was in Florida, I was in Texas. I stepped out in the hall because I was crying, and a woman in the room across the hall beckoned me into her room. I've never seen her before or since. And she said, "Your mother's going to be all right." And I said, "Oh, you don't understand. Her illness is terminal." And she said, "I didn't say she's going to get well. I said she's going to be all right." And Mother did not get well, and she's been all right ever since. And when I got to you, it's as if you had said to me, "You're going to be all right." And I would have said, "You don't understand. I have a very fragile, sick marriage." And you would have said, "I didn't say we'd save your marriage. I said you're going to be all right." Or I would have said to you, I have a barely sober husband." And you would have said, "Hey, we didn't say anything about a sober husband. We said you're going to be all right." That's what I heard. And I have been. And better than that, I know that I will be. Well, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And I agree with Father Martin, who says when he's sitting out there and you're standing up here, he says, "You're playing with my life. Don't tell me how sick you got without telling me how well you have gotten." And it would be denying the power of God in my life if I didn't share with you my recovery, because through His grace I have a great deal of it. My goodness, if you haven't gotten some recovery in 22 years, you haven't been trying, you know. You'd get it by osmosis. I was born and grew up in Florida. I lived the first 10 years of my life just below the Georgia border in Jacksonville, and then until I married in Pensacola, which is on the Alabama border, which is very much deep south. We were fourth generation Floridians. We were not tourists. Tourist was a bad word. If I ever did anything my mother thought appropriate in the way I dressed or the way I behaved, she would say, "Don't act like a tourist." So I'm a very good tourist when I go places. I know how to behave. I had a charming, handsome, sensitive, intelligent Irish alcoholic father. And he was violent. I was never, thank God, sexually abused, but I was a badly battered child. And it was years before I could say that from a podium. And it needs saying, because it is not that rare in alcoholic homes. And let me say quickly, it is not always the alcoholic who is the violent one. It just happened to be at our house. My parents were divorced when I was 8. A couple of years later, my mother remarried a very kind man who, as it happened, didn't drink at all. We were never close, but we both loved my mother, and there was a great deal of affection and caring between us. While we were living with my own father, we lived in abject poverty. I don't mean we didn't have luxuries. I mean there was not enough to eat. For days on end, there was not enough to wear. And we had very inadequate shelter. We lived in a very blighted area of Jacksonville. Poverty has nothing to recommend it. It does not ennoble the human character. Hunger is a demeaning and a debasing way to live. Don't let anyone tell you anything different. I have to mention that because even in the area where we lived, the neighborhood children were not allowed to play with me. I know now that their parents were understandably apprehensive about what was going on at our house, but at that time I just felt rejection and rage. And my thinking was that I would get back at them some way, somehow. And it turned out that I could do that in school. I could beat the socks off of them, and I did, and I relished every minute of it. And I became my way up and out, and it became far too important to me, of course. That's when I bought into a set of rules, man-made rules, that worked for me and also served to make me pretty sick until I got to you. My thinking was, if you didn't like me, you would, by golly, respect me, and I saw to it that you did. And I did the right thing, and if I didn't know what it was, I found out. And my life was like one of those paint-by-number sets, you know? You just didn't get outside the lines. Even when my mother remarried, there were no luxuries. We did have enough to eat, and we had a home. But when I wanted to go to college, there was certainly no money for it. And besides, I wanted to go to Baylor University, and that's how I got to Texas, because that's where it happens to be. My mother said a few things about this. One, if you can pay for it, go ahead. And she also said, if you want to go to college in Texas, it's all right with me. But she said, make up your mind that if you do, you'll live the rest of your life out there because you'll end up marrying a Texan and they don't transplant, she said. I told her I was going to do no such thing, but I did, and they don't, and I have, and so she was right about that as she was everything else. I'm sure you know that Texas is a state of mind. They have never forgotten that they were a nation, and that is the feeling that is prevalent there. My father-in-law was a very ardent Texan. I don't know any other kind. And he says he reared his children never to ask a man where he was from, because he said if he's from Texas, he'll tell you, and if he's not, it's not nice to embarrass him. He also said there are no ex-Texans. There are some Texans forced to live somewhere else for a while, maybe 50 or 60 years, but they are never ex-Texans. I think now that it was inevitable that I marry an alcoholic. I know now that a person does not come untreated out of an alcoholic home and make a healthy marriage. But I tried so hard to avoid it, I would not date anyone who drank at all. And that wasn't difficult at Baylor, which is like a Baptist convent. Most people didn't drink. If you did, you got sent home. And when I married my husband, he didn't drink at all. And I thought that made me safe. You explained to me later that did not mean the disease wasn't there. You said it's as if he had had tuberculosis and he had just not yet started hemorrhaging. That symptom had not yet manifest itself. And you said that drinking is only a symptom of the alcoholism. And I, of course, didn't see it coming. We were blindsided by it. I know now that sick people marry sick people and they rear sick children. And please don't let anyone tell you anything different. I was one of those children. I taught thousands of them, and I reared two of my own. And if you think the drinking at your house didn't affect your children, I have some swampland in Florida I'd like to talk to you about, because you'll believe anything. I thought Jennifer was so beautiful. My children later were in Alateen for 10 years each, and you helped to undo some of the god-awful damage that we did to them. I know now that we kind of find each other. Okay, I got my feelings of self-worth by rescuing and taking care of. So, of course, I found someone who would give me chances regularly to rescue and take care of him. Of course I did. I didn't know I had any intrinsic worth just by existing or just by living. And I know now that we don't get sick just as a result of living with alcoholism. The Al-Anons in California say every pot finds a lid that will fit it. And in Colorado, they say the horns on the heads of the alcoholics just fit the holes in ours. So of course we found each other. We lived in Corpus Christi for a year and then in San Antonio for 4 years. Our children were born there. Then we moved to West Texas to a town called Odessa, which was my husband's hometown. The landscape of West Texas is somewhat akin to that of the moon. And my mother used to refer to this city as Odessolate. Not where anyone could hear her. And that's where we got our sickest, and that's where we found you. During the drinking years, I had some slogans that I know now I lived by before you gave me some different slogans. I bet you had some of these. One of them was, "What will people think?" Did you have that one? And, "Don't rock the boat." "Whatever it takes, you know, peace at any price." And this one, "It's not that bad yet." And did you ever play "Guess What I'm Mad At?" You are exhibiting what psychologists call a recognition reflex. Charles used to say that I could ask him a question, answer it myself, and go away mad. Wasn't true, of course. I did all the wrong things during the drinking years. I protected and I lied and I rescued, and this man was almost literally loved to death. And that can happen. I played Let's Pretend as diligently as he drank, and I was as obsessed with him as he was with drinking. You know what obsession is. Did you hear about the Al-Anon who was drowning? Someone else's life flashed in front of her eyes. That's obsession. Now, I would like you to think that I stayed during those years out of love and loyalty. I did not. I stayed out of pride. And when I'm this far from home, I have to kind of explain what I mean by that. Growing up in the Deep South, at least in my generation, we got a very specific kind of upbringing. We were expected to flutter our eyelashes and flash our dimples and swish our skirts, but it was understood that we were made of stainless steel and we could cope. You know, Scarlett O'Hara in the sweet potato field. I'll never be hungry again. And one did not air one's dirty linen in public. And if you lived with a man, you didn't criticize him to other people. And you could tell a southern lady by her hands and her feet. And you took care of those no matter how hard you had to work. And of course, you never went anywhere without a white linen handkerchief. And that imprinting took on me. And so I stayed out of pride. I had never failed at anything in my life, and I wasn't going to start with my marriage. If it fell apart, nobody would know about it. See, I was keeping the rules, and that's what the rules said. So my answer was to try harder. I could really hear it when I got to Al-Anon later, and our welcome and preamble said that we tried to force solutions. I certainly tried to. You get the Charlie Brown cartoon strip up here. One time, Charlie Brown's little sister is learning long division, and she says to Charlie Brown, "How many times will 24 go into 12? And he says, "24 won't go into 12. And she says, "It will if you push." That was my thinking. And I felt that I had a very inauspicious beginning, a very difficult childhood. I married considerably above myself. Charles says I shouldn't say that. I don't know any other way to say it. I married into a fine old family that had had a great deal of money and still had a great deal of prestige and status. And I didn't see why he had to drink. I was the one, it seemed to me, who would have an excuse for drinking. I had attended the university I wanted, which was and is very expensive, and I paid for it myself. And I married the man I wanted, and he was and is brilliant and handsome and can be charming. And I had the children I wanted when I wanted them. And if I have time, I'll try to convince you in a few minutes that they are altogether remarkable. And so I had no understanding of nor tolerance for people who messed up their lives. My thinking was that if I could cope, anybody could cope. And so I was mystified by this. All the rules I had followed weren't working. And I hadn't yet found you to give me some spiritual laws that do work. I did a few things right during those worst years. I never called him a drunk, and I never thought of him as a drunk. He was a fine man who drank too much, who had what my Irish grandmother called the failing. And at some level, I knew that he was sick. At least I knew that nobody would be that way because he wanted to be. Please remember that 25 years ago, it wasn't trendy to be alcoholic. You know, it wasn't the end thing. And you didn't see announcements on television every 30 minutes. And it was not widely accepted as an illness, and certainly nobody thought of it as a family illness. I didn't criticize him to the children. I did after he sobered up. But when he was drinking, I didn't. So that when he tried tentatively to reach out to them in love later, they were willing and waiting to be loved. And I had a God whom I worshipped and served, and who was my handhold on sanity until I got to you. Not God as I understand him today. But I hope in another 22 years, God, as I understand him, will be different from the way the grasp I have on him today. And I had a doctor who served as Al-Anon, and I say that because he used to say, you have to do what's necessary for your sanity and your serenity regardless. He said, and he knew just which button to push, he said, your children need one stable parent. See, need was the operative word. If you said need to me, I was putty in your hands. I'd roll over and play dead. It didn't matter. Whatever. I still respond to that. I don't always have to act on it, though, today. And so he suggested, the doctor, that I return to teaching. I had stayed home 12 years when my children were little because the rules said no good mother worked outside her home. And besides, I wanted very much to stay home with them when they were little. I had taught school before they were born, and I loved it, and I missed it. But I'm not a spontaneous or impulsive person. I wish I were. I try to be. It took me a year after he suggested it, and he wrote it on a prescription pad. It took me a year to do it. I went back to teaching. Now, there are people who think I taught 11th grade English in a very fine, very affluent high school. Most of the years, that's where I was. There are people who think that 150 17-year-olds a day do not constitute therapy. There are those who suggest that if you aren't already sick, that might do it. And I never talk without saying, don't criticize kids to me. You'll have to fight me first. As gently as I know how to say this to you, I believe I know more of them than you do. I have accumulated several thousand through the years. And I believe I know them better in an English class where we share feelings and thoughts than perhaps a math or science teacher gets to know them. That was my privilege. And they were a beautiful enrichment in my life. I have not been teaching the last few years, and I miss it. It's like an ache. I like their gung-ho eagerness for living. I like their values, which are sounder than those of my generation. They have a concern for this planet that you and I did not know. Now, it was not one long honeymoon, okay? There were days when I wished for retroactive birth control, but not usually. What happened was that Charles never quit trying to find an answer. And I did then, and I do now respect him very much for that. He went to ministers and to lay counselors and to medical doctors and through clinics. He went through both our local psychiatrists pretty quickly, and nobody ever said alcoholic to him. The one thing he drank at home, he didn't like people who would hang out in bars. He says the way you create a good crop of Al-Anons and Alateens is to drink at home. Because he had me to protect him, he didn't have any painful consequences from his drinking at all. And as he says, you don't get a DWI while driving a sofa. So it wasn't until he went to a psychologist, a woman who was doing counseling in Odessa at that time. Strange, eccentric lady. It'll tell you something about her when I tell you that his first appointment with her was at 12:30 a.m. And it'll tell you something about him when I tell you he was there. He kept it. He'd been seeing her for about 6 weeks, and it was January of 1964. Are there moments in your life that are so filled with lucidity, so clear, so graced, that you remember exactly where you were and what you were doing? I remember the room, I remember the carpet, the draperies, everything, when the phone rang that day. And this woman identified herself. Of course, I recognized her name. And she said, "I have been talking with your husband for some time now. He's an alcoholic, and this is a family illness." And all of my Deep South upbringing went out the window, and I said, "You're out of your mind," and hung up. She had hit a nerve, and I didn't want to talk about it. Before I could leave the room, the phone rang again, and when I picked it up, she said, "Hey, don't hang up. Wait a minute. I know what you've been through." Well, she couldn't know. I hadn't told anybody. This was the most anonymous alcoholic in town. And I thought all my tears had long since been shed. And I stood there with that phone in my hand, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried. That was your first gift to me, before I ever even got to you, was the freedom to cry. Charles used to say I could cry at supermarket openings or reading menus or telephone directories. I do cry whenever I please. I used to cry at pep rallies at school. The school where I taught, football was second only to oxygen in importance. And the pep rallies were somewhat like Broadway productions. And the school almost always won the state title, and there are 254 high schools in its class in Texas. Took it seriously. And I would look at these marvelous young people who thought they had the world by the tail and think what tough rows some of them would be hoeing, you know? And I can get teary right now thinking of that. So I had the freedom to cry now because you gave it to me. You know, when you're living with alcoholism, I don't think this happens on a conscious level, but it seems to me that we sort of reason out, I'm going to shut down some of these feelings because they hurt too much. It's as if they had faucets or valves. I'm going to turn off the one marked anger, and I'm going to turn off the one marked self-pity and resentment. And what I didn't know is that there's one valve, and it's marked feelings. And so when I got to you, I was emotionally frozen, and you really loved me back to life. And up here, of all places, you know that when the feeling comes back after something has been frozen, it is painful. And whenever, for years, whenever I hurt in a new place, it would be some little frozen pocket that had not yet thawed. It's been a long time, though, since that has happened. It was this counselor who sent us to you all, and for 6 months, I went only to open meetings. If anyone had the questionable judgment to invite me to Al-Anon, I explained that I had not done the drinking and I did not need the therapy. I was brought up that if you don't like someone, you're never rude, you're kind but cool. So that's what I was to these people. And I wouldn't even go to an open meeting if Charles was due to get any memento of sobriety. Do your groups have that? 30 days and 90 days. I didn't want to hear him say, "My name is Charles and I'm an alcoholic." In July of that year, we went to San Antonio for the 4th of July weekend. I mentioned that we had lived there, our babies were born there, and it's a beautiful city, and we went back every chance we got. Besides, every now and then you just have to go see a tree, you know. And Charles got drunk. He says, "I must never tell anyone it was a slip. It was a carefully planned drunk." And I know now it was not the worst one nor the longest one, and I did not expect him to stay sober. That attitude must have helped him a lot too, don't you think? At any rate, I was driving home. To this man's credit, he never drove drinking or hungover. And he said, "I'm going to have to tell my group about this next week because I'm due to get a 6-month chip." And in my appalling ignorance, I said, "I won't tell anybody." And he explained to me that isn't the name of the game. Now, I have to tell you that to tell you that's what got my attention. We had been married 14 years at that time, and this man had never once said to me, "I'm sorry, I was wrong, I made a mistake." And he was going to go down there and say it to some people he had known 6 months, and it made me mad. I had quite a few barriers to overcome in that area. I had prayed for help, but I certainly thought God was not showing very good taste. And I told you I'd married above myself. I lived in a town where I did not have to spell my name for anybody and where I had a great deal of automatic respect and prestige. And I didn't want to risk that. There was nobody not allowed to play with me anymore. I was afraid if I went down there with those people, I'd lose all that. And so I was angry. Besides, next to an alcoholic, anybody looks good, you know? And I got back to the meetings with him, and they were saying, "Way to go, Charlie, hang in there, you know, 30 days, fine." Nobody was telling me I was wonderful. They were hinting rather broadly I could use some help. Nobody had ever done that to me in my life. And of course I was angry. Besides, you took away my whipping boy, my scapegoat. You see, if you're married to an alcoholic, anything that goes wrong can be blamed on the problem, capital P. And I couldn't blame it on him anymore. And you were forcing me to look at me. So, it was at this point that someone asked me to Al-Anon, and I heard her. And I used to say, I don't know why her invitation reached me when no one else has had. Well, I have done three, I think, very comprehensive and thorough fourth and fifth steps. And in my very first one, God revealed to me why her invitation reached me. And rigorous honesty requires that I tell you, and I wish I didn't have to. But this was a woman I considered as good as I was. Okay? I mean, I'm sorry. That's what it took. It takes what it takes. She had intelligence and beauty and brains and breeding and status and prestige and money and all of those things that I considered important. She still has everything I consider important, but it's a different list this afternoon. She became my sponsor, and she was my sponsor for 11 years until she moved away, and I got another one. And if I had another hour to talk to you, I would get on my soapbox and I would talk about sponsorship. I don't understand the enormity of the ego that presumes to get into and go through a program like this alone. I have no patience with people who talk all over the country and who have no sponsors and no home group. There is no place for gurus and disciples in this fellowship. And I will give... I will give you my sponsor's name and phone number, and you may check on me at any time. Because I use her regularly. We have a pamphlet in Al-Anon called Living with Sobriety, and in it they have written, while sobriety can be a welcome miracle, it does not guarantee happiness. And I believe I'm quoting Bill Wilson correctly, who said, we consider that man unthinking who says that sobriety is enough. It was essential, but it was not enough, and we had a very difficult, stormy. The first 18 months were unmitigated hell. They were worse than anything we had ever had drinking. Charles was stark, raving, sober, and very much aware of all of my defects of character, and no longer held back by guilt from mentioning them loudly and clearly and frequently. And I was having to give up the overlay of fantasy, the let's pretend, that I had had for so long. We get into Al-Anon with varying degrees of illness. I was in pretty bad shape. For one thing, I had to learn to express needs. I thought you were supposed to read my mind, and I don't know about the people in your family, but the ones in my family failed their mind reading course, and nobody could. And so I learned to say I need and I want, rather than be angry because you couldn't automatically assume that and fill that need. And I learned it because you were willing to say to me, I need and I want. You didn't require that I read your mind and then get angry because I couldn't. I would so much rather you say to me, I need a hug, than to walk away feeling unloved by me because I didn't know that you needed one. I think we come in with defensive walls all around us. And they are not always walls of hiding or withdrawal. I used to hear people in my group talk about having, during the drinking years, not answered the phone or the doorbell, and they had withdrawn from society altogether. I joined everything in town and ran most of them. And when I'd been with you 2 or 3 weeks and you didn't ask me to be president, my feelings were hurt. I thought, you obviously didn't know who I was. And that was my wall. The barrenness of busyness. And that will do it. Compulsive talking can be a wall. People who never shut up never get to know us. And certainly they don't really let us know them. Mindless laughter can be a wall. You know, the people who, when you say good morning, break into peals of shrieking laughter, you know. There are all kinds of walls, not just withdrawal. And I no longer batter at them. I used to. Let me in. I want to be your friend, you know. I think that's kind of an emotional rape. I don't do that anymore. If you have a defense, you need it. And I believe that when you feel safe enough, you will give it up. I think it's like having a shield and a sword, you know, to protect ourselves, those of us who don't trust in particular. And it's a joy to me to see people put down the sword. And eventually, some of them put down the shield, too. Eventually. I think what we can do is that when these people look out from the chinks in their armor, we can smile and let them know the natives are friendly. And I think if we are warm and loving enough, sometimes the bricks in these walls will thaw and melt. That's what happened with me, and I began to hear you. Not all at once and not all from one person. I can tell it to you much more quickly than I learned it. But I heard, of course, do you realize you're sick too? See, as I said, it wasn't commonly acknowledged that this was a family illness. They said, then, do you want to get well? Even in Scripture, no one could be healed who didn't want to get well. Some people need their neuroses, and they hang on to them. And then they said, you have a great many old ideas that have to go. Well-meaning people, I think, tell us things that they believe to be true and that I had to unlearn before I could hear you. My sponsor said, God can only fill an empty vessel. First, get rid of some of these old ideas. She said, you cannot put new wine in an old bottle. I had been taught, for instance, and I'll bet you were too, that God helps those who help themselves. He does not, you know. He helps those who ask. And the times I have needed him most desperately, I could not have helped myself if my life depended on it, and it very nearly did. God helps those who ask. I was brought up that mature people don't need help. Learning to ask for help was the hardest thing I ever did. I wouldn't ask for directions in a strange town. I would buy a map. I guess if I had broken my leg, I would have tried to set it. I don't know. But it was a weakness to ask for help. And you said no. You said babies are dependent, but adolescents are independent. They have to be for a while. You know that I can do it myself. And that mature people are healthily interdependent. And that is not a sick, clinging neediness, but that's a healthy counting on each other. I found out that some pain is necessary for my spiritual education, but misery is optional. And I don't opt to be miserable anymore. I holler for help loudly and clearly. If you could see my long-distance charges, you would believe me. I have some friends in California who, when I can't make it through the night, still happen to be up. I have a friend there who swears I only love her for her time zone. And if it's really rough, there are some friends in Hawaii that are still up, too. You know? There was a country western song popular long about the time I got to you all, and it was saying she didn't have sense enough to come in out of the pain. Well, I have sense enough today. I don't hurt very long. I was taught that we put other people first, always, under any circumstances. That was the noble thing to do. I know now that constant self-sacrifice builds a huge reservoir of rage in the person who is doing it. I had suffered nobly, you know, like a martyr. I practically required plastic surgery to remove my hand from my forehead. And you said I had not only a responsibility for taking care of myself emotionally. That it was no one else's job. That it was not God's assignment to anyone on earth to make me happy. You said that was an inside job and that it was up to me to see that my needs were filled. I'm not talking about me first, okay? I'm talking about my turn, because I didn't even know how to do that until I got to you. But I have a sponsor who says that I must ask myself two things before any challenging situation, and one is, what is in my best interests? Now, you can't be a martyr and do that. And the other is to remind myself that I don't have to like any situation, but it is imperative that I like myself in it. A few years ago, I went through a very agonizingly painful divorce, and I didn't like that situation. But oh, it feels good to know I would not change one word I said or one thing I did, because you had told me that I must like myself, even in the most painful situations. I was told that I could never say no in Al-Anon, and I know this sounds like heresy, but I do say it. It's a way I have to take care of myself. I have to say no more than I say yes, or I would have nothing to give you when I come. Every time that phone rings, it is not God calling. And sometimes I have to say no. I was taught that what you don't know won't hurt you. What I didn't know nearly killed 4 people. You know, what you don't know can kill you. And on, there was this list of things that I had been taught that were wrong. And I had to unlearn them before I could hear you. And when I finally could, I didn't want to settle for a spiritual band-aid, you know. I am greedy for this program, and I'm attracted to people who are greedy for it and who want it all. And that's when I began to learn these spiritual laws that replace the man-made ones that I was living by so rigorously. And they are just as real, by the way, and just as irrevocable as the law of gravity. For instance, if I climb into a tall building and I jump out, I go down. I don't go up. I have not broken the law of gravity. I have just illustrated it. Right? Okay, when you tell me that even a justified resentment will make me sick, that's a spiritual law. And of course, all of mine were justified, I mean. When you tell me this, and I insist on holding a resentment anyway, in my case, I have arthritis flare-up, and I have severe and incapacitating migraine. I have not broken that spiritual law that says resentment will make you sick. I have just illustrated it. And I seem to insist on doing that time and again. I do know something about words. And the S-E-N-T in resent comes from the Latin word for feeling. We get sentiment from the same root. So if we resent, we re-feel it. And the way I know that I have a resentment is whether or not I can remember whatever it was without anger. If I remember it and I get mad all over again, that's the red flag. That means it is a resentment. And these spiritual laws are so much stricter and more exacting than the man-made ones. It's easier for me to stay within the speed limit and not to cheat on my income tax than it is for me to love you unconditionally. But that's a spiritual law. And if, as the scriptures say, we were made in the image of God, and I believe that we were, and if, as they say, God is love, and I believe that he is, then we were built for loving. And these other feelings are like throwing sand in an engine. You know, we don't function well on them. So I love you this afternoon because I choose to, and you have nothing to say about it. It's a lot of fun for me, and it won't hurt you. I know you didn't come here because you wanted to contribute to my therapy, but that's what you're doing. You're helping me with my recovery. I have learned that the worst immorality is judgment. And I have learned to be very careful, because every time I find myself sitting in judgment on someone for certain behavior, God has handed me that situation. So far, it hasn't failed. And I'm really afraid to be too judgmental anymore. I don't want any more of those handed to me, to find myself in exactly the position for which I was criticizing the other person. Of course, you talked to me about releasing. You said, let go of this man. You detach from the problem, not the person. You said, if you don't like the warts, let go of the frog. And I didn't like the warts. I didn't like the person I had become. I am not basically a bitch or a shrew, and I was both. I was somebody I didn't know. I had lost whatever identity I had. And I didn't like those warts at all, and so I tried to let go of the frog. That's the single hardest thing I still do in the program, is let go, let go, let go. Sometimes I have to release with anger before I can with love. Sometimes I have to withdraw emotionally for a while before I can release it all. And everything I've ever released in my life has claw marks all over it. But I am able to do it today, at least to some extent. See, I could release because you told me that God could work directly through my husband and children. I didn't know that. I thought he had to come through me. I always told them God's will for their lives. And teacher that I am, I had to have a visual aid. And the way I can let go of people is to visualize them held in the hollow of God's hand. And I am not abandoning them. I am turning them over to God, who loves them even more than I can, and might possibly know better what's best for them. I'm never sure of that second part, but I am sure of the loving part. I think a real symptom of untreated Al-Anonism is rush in and rescue. And I have to sit on my hands and bite my tongue not to do it time and time again now. Today I can listen to your feelings without trying to fix you. Now you understand every cell of my being wants to fix you. But today I don't have to act on that. I don't have to give you advice. That surprised me when I heard that we don't give advice in the program, because I thought, how do we help each other? I know now that we do it by helping each other see what our available options are. See, when I got to you, I thought I had three options: that I could divorce this man, or I could live with him while we both tried to recover in the program, or I could have a close, warm, loving, communicative marriage. So I opted for number three, and unfortunately that was not one of my available options. And any time I am miserable today, it's because I have chosen something that was not an available choice. And sometimes I need you to point that out to me. I can't always see what the options are, and more importantly, what they are not. That's what we can do for each other. And one of my problems in choosing is thinking that if I make the right choice, it will be happy, joyous, and free. It will be bliss. Sometimes it's which kind of pain can you live with best. You know that.
And you said to me, we can't say that you won't hurt. Sometimes it's just a choice of what to do while you're hurting, you know. But you said you won't ever have to hurt alone again. And I quit translating for the children. Did you ever do that? Now, honey, what your daddy meant was, you did. I can tell. You did. Our children were in Alateen for 10 years each. If I had time, I would tell you some of the stories that I love to tell about the added dimension to family life it gives to have your kids in the program, too. They did a great deal of speaking for Alateen, and my son was on the state board. They were very active, strong Alateens. See, I could have told you, and I did if you let me, how much harm their father had done them during the drinking. But you told me how much harm I had done them, and I thought I could not stand that. For 3 years, I was on the literature committee in New York, and we tried very hard to write a pamphlet for Alateen on how to handle your resentment toward the non-alcoholic. Because unless the alcoholic is violent, generally the non-alcoholic is resented more. We can't, you know, make a general statement, but as a rule, that's the way it is. At our house, for instance, all they could see was their father, they thought, asleep on the sofa. They didn't know passed out. And they knew something was wrong with him, but what was wrong with this crazy woman who was yelling and screaming and throwing things, you know? Which one would you resent? And I was the villain, and I was the heavy, and I was the disciplinarian. So, of course, I was the one that they resented. And I'll be grateful all my life for the 10 years of intensive care that you gave them. You told me, too, that I was not responsible for the drinking. I thought I was. Charles always said I was, and I believed everything he told me. And just when I breathed a sigh of relief over that, you said, on the other hand, you're entirely responsible for your own behavior. I didn't want to hear that. As I said, I had had a whipping boy, and you took that away. And you told me that I could choose my reaction, that otherwise I was in emotional slavery. You know, I thought if he got angry and I got angry, it showed we were close. So if he got depressed, I got depressed. It's as if I woke up every morning and said to him, good morning, how do I feel today? It was entirely up to him. I hope I do not ever again give that much power to another human being. In Charles' defense, he never asked for that. You know, I just gave it to him. I handed my self-worth to this man on a platter, and I said, what I think of me will depend on you. And, you know, and he didn't want that. And you said, you can take your sails out of his wind, and nobody has to decide the direction in which I go today. It does not depend on other people. And I have so slowly learned to take the risk of being who I am within the bounds of love and courtesy, as my sponsor always adds, and pay the emotional price that that costs, and sometimes that's pretty high. It cost me a marriage. But the price I was paying for not being who I am was costing me more. You told me that love isn't dependency, that it has to be given for fun and for free, and that we cannot usually give it on our terms. I have a son who is 6'3". It seems to me he's been that tall since he was 5. Surely not. But if I could, I would show him I love him by cuddling him in my lap and cooing, and he would just die. So since he was about 17, I've had to show him I love him by not saying when he still lived at home, who was that letter from? Who was that on the phone? And when he had his own apartment, why did a girl answer the phone when I called at 7:30 in the morning? I don't say those things. I'm not allowed to love him on my terms, but on terms that he can handle and with which he is comfortable. And that coin has another side, too. We don't get love on our terms. I am so verbally oriented that if you don't tell me in words, I don't know it. I wish I could just pick it up psychically, but I don't. You have to come to me and say, Blanche, watch my lips. I am depressed. Then I know what to do. But I won't know if you don't tell me. And I had a sponsor who said, you must learn to listen for love. And if you don't demand it on your terms, you'll be inundated with it. And so I tried. And one time this boy, when he was 15, that was during his grunting stage. If you've reared a teenage boy, you know you go through this time when you say, how was your day? And they say, oh. Did you have a good time? Oh. And at that point in life, he could not have said, I love you, if his life depended on it. He certainly says it today in every conversation. But then he couldn't, and he came home one day and threw his books down and said to me, I'm so glad you're not just some dumb broad like most of the ding-a-ling women I see. Isn't that poetry? Music? I could hear I love you. And when a student said, I don't like English, but this is my favorite class. Or, I don't write poems, but here, these are for you. I could hear I love you. And when my daughter, who could only cook one thing along that time, said, you want spaghetti for supper? No, I could hear I love you. Since I quit demanding it on my terms, I do. I do hear a great deal of it. I've learned to listen for it. I've got to hurry. I did not, of course, get the program all at once. I still don't have it all. I learned it slowly and painfully, through blood, sweat, and tears, incident by incident, 124 hours at a time. And some days I still ask, what program? God who? And I will call somebody who will tell me what program and God who. Usually in the words I've used with them. Don't you hate that? They say, well, as you've said to me, and I say, don't do that to me. I don't have to have that today, you know. But there is someone to tell me, and I do know enough to listen today. And I let myself have relapses, by the way. It took me a while. For a long time, I had to be Mrs. Al-Anon. I don't have to do that anymore. I am able to be compassionate with myself when I have a slip on the program, and I do. I'll tell you about one of my most recent ones. It was 2 years ago, maybe. I was visiting my son in Dallas, and on my way to Little Rock, Arkansas to see my daughter for Thanksgiving. Bright, sunshiny morning, no excuse in the world. We were going down the stairs of his condo, and I have an arthritic knee that gave way, and I fell. And it was a very bad fall, and I was unconscious, and he called the paramedics, and they took me to the hospital, and I don't remember any of that. But as they were lifting me from the stretcher in the ambulance to the gurney in the emergency room, I sort of came to, in time to hear the nurse saying, now just lay back and take deep breaths. And coming out of absolute oblivion, I said, honey, that's lie back. I will lie back and take deep breaths. I immediately lost consciousness again. But when I came to, I couldn't stop. I said, you see, you say it so often every day, you really should learn to say it correctly. My son was covering his eyes with his hands. He was saying, she doesn't do this to total strangers usually. Really, she doesn't. Fortunately, the nurse thought it was funny, fortunately. My point to you is, let my defenses get down, and I am going to straighten out the world. And that is my untreated Al-Anonism. And if I don't watch it, I will slip back into that regularly. But because you told me that practice makes progress, not perfection, then I keep practicing. You also told me that recovery, thank God, is progressive too, not just the illness. The weller we get, the weller we can get. English teachers are allowed to make up their own words. It's in our contract. Of course I talk the talk better than I walk the walk. Of course I do. And I walk the walk better than I feel the feeling. But I'm still the best Blanche that I have ever had. I watch new people come into the program and hit it running and learn so much more in a year than I did for the first five. I have figured out why, by the way. 22 years ago, we didn't have us. Does that make sense? Okay. My sponsor had 13 months. I thought she knew everything. We had one hardback book in Al-Anon and 10 pamphlets. We were the blind leading the blind. And there was no one who had 5, 10, 15, much less 20 years. Al-Anon hadn't been around 20 years, you know. And so I'm awed by the vigor of the new people embracing this program. But I do remember to take a little bit of credit for that, for those of us who have been around a while. These children I've mentioned to you are fine today, thank you. And I mean literally, thank you. Because you're the ones who healed them. My daughter is a journalist. She works for the St. Petersburg Times, which it seems, if you didn't know, and I didn't, is a very prestigious newspaper in St. Petersburg, Florida. She was married how long ago? 7 years. And because you told her she could be who she is in that subversive organization, Alateen, you told her that. When it was time for this wedding, she said, there's no rule that says that your attendant has to be a girl, and my brother is the person I love most in the world, and I want him to stand with me when we're married. And before I could open my mouth and give them the benefit of my wisdom, Her brother said, "Hey, that's great. I've never been a brides person before." The groom said, "Well, you know, in that case, I'm really closer to my sister than I am my brother." Now you're getting ahead of me. So he said, "I'll ask her." So we had a best woman and a man of honor. It was beautiful. The minister was a lovely young woman who had gone to college with our daughter. And my daughter's a writer, and so is her husband, and they wrote their own ceremony, and it was very moving. And I sat there and I cried in the time-honored fashion of the mother of the bride, thinking sobriety made this possible. You see, when things were so sick at our house, these two young people used to watch when my brothers came to visit and say, "You hugged your brother, yuck," you know. And I was afraid when they left our home, they would never see each other again. And this was the person she loved most in the world, and this was the one she wanted with her when she married. My son is a commercial photographer in Dallas, and he does very well indeed. He has been on his own for maybe the last 5 years. He won a Clio a couple of years ago, which is the Oscar of advertising. It's the highest award you can get for one of his pictures. We date the people we meet, and he meets models. And I visit with him a lot at the Dallas airport, because when I'm going to share Al-Anon somewhere, I frequently have to change planes in the Dallas airport. If you leave Texas, you know, you'd go to Dallas first. We've said that when you die, before you go to heaven or hell, you'll go to Dallas first. So when I have 2 or 3 hours, he sometimes comes out and visits with me, always with one of these gorgeous young things on his arm. They all weigh 36 pounds and have legs up to their armpits. I have told him that if I want to feel frumpy, I can stay home and iron, you know? I don't have to look at these. Well. He has given me a great many more people to love, as happens with our children's friends, if we will let it. And I have stayed in touch with them long after he is no longer involved with them, because I don't break up with them when he does. And they enrich my life too. I'm going to have to close with something that I'm afraid you will hear as bad news. Now, please don't. This is not bad news. This is what was necessary for my recovery and for Charles. Relationships, like people, you know, sometimes die. And we really lost our marriage in about 1977 for a variety of reasons that it would not be at all appropriate for me to go into from behind a podium. And for 3 years, we tried to bring life back into it. It was like giving artificial respiration to a corpse. There was nothing we could do. It was a relationship that had been damaged beyond repair. You know, it was sick beyond healing. And I remembered your telling me that marriages made in sickness often don't survive health. I had not wanted to hear it, but I know that it's true. Often they don't. We had nothing to go back to. And our recovery took us down different roads and in different directions. People who love us always want to know. So I've taken to saying, "No, he did not leave me for another woman." And "No, I did not throw him out for another man." And "No, he did not resume drinking. He'll have 22 years of sobriety in July." The marriage died. You can applaud him. But something toxic happens when we try to relate to each other that doesn't seem to happen when we relate to other people. This had become such a destructive relationship, and we care too much about each other to destroy each other. We couldn't gain any further recovery within the frame of a relationship that was this sick. So in April of 1980, we released each other with dignity and respect. We really did, to follow new lives and new directions, and our divorce was final in August of that year. Now, we have tried to remain friendly, but I would be lying if I said we are friends. We're not. Friends share feelings, and friends joy in each other's presence, and if we could have done that, we could have stayed married. It was because we couldn't do that, you know, that we weren't married. But there is no villain. There's no one wearing a black hat here. Now, lest you think this is a storybook divorce, I will tell you that I am enraged that this man has been able, with his new friends and as of a couple of years ago, a new wife, to do and be everything I always wanted him to do and be. And he either could not or would not within the framework of our own marriage. It seems to me these people are getting effortlessly everything I yearned for 30 years. On my saner days, I can rejoice in this evidence of his recovery. But most of the time, I am just mad as hell that he wouldn't do this in time to save our own marriage. I don't like it but then I don't have to. I only have to like myself in it, remember? Nobody wants divorce. I mean, listen, I wanted us to grow old together, watch our grandchildren playing, put our teeth in the same glass, you know, on the nightstand. But I never felt more direct guidance in my life than I felt with this decision. And I was never more healthily Al-Anon than when I determined that I would go to any lengths to get well, too. Because you didn't turn loose of them for 10 years, our children were able to be mutually supportive. The weekend that Charles moved out, our son flew out from Dallas to help him. And he alternated moving a piece of furniture for his father and sitting on the sofa and holding me while I cried, and then moving another piece of furniture for his father. And 2 weeks after the divorce was final, it was our daughter who called on what would have been our 30th anniversary and said, "I know this has been a difficult day for you." And so they have been there for both of us. Ending a 30-year marriage is like an amputation. The agony is intense, no matter how necessary it might be for survival. And there is a phantom pain where the relationship used to be. You told me the tragedy of suffering is not that it happens, but that it is wasted and that I must not let it be wasted. You said, "You don't back God into a corner and say, 'Why me?' I mean, after all, why not me?" But you must ask, "What am I supposed to understand?" And so that's what I have been asking. And I don't have all the answers yet, but I do have a few. I think I'm supposed to understand that I don't have to know what the future holds because I know who holds the future. I think I'm supposed to understand, and for a woman of my generation, this is no small thing. I'm a whole person without a man. And that means the men who are in my life today are there because we both want them to be. Not because one of us has a loose umbilical cord that we're trying to plug into somebody, you know, as a life support system. Oh, you've run across that. I want to say, too, because I think people need to know it, these children have not had to drink. They didn't have to do drugs. They didn't have to do a lot of bed hopping. They have had loving commitments, and that doesn't bother me. Promiscuity would have bothered me. They've never even had a cavity. I tell them to tell the dentist that was excellent parenting. But the reason I tell it to you is to say, growing up in an alcoholic home does not necessarily mean that the kids have to do what we did. And I think the reason they don't is that you gave them 10 years of intensive care. I certainly don't take credit for it myself. I can only make one major decision a year, so after the divorce, I investigated graduate schools. I decided I would go back to school and get another degree. And I ended up at the University of Texas in Austin, and I moved there in June of 1982. It was very difficult to pull up roots, to leave my comfort zone, to sell the house my children grew up in. I had to remind myself that the house was only brick and wood, and I could take the memories with me. You would have laughed at me in graduate school. To begin with, I felt older than God. And I kept wanting to teach the class. The professor wouldn't explain it well enough. And I wanted to say, "Now, honey, what the professor meant was..." I also wanted to correct their grammar, but I don't do that when I'm not unconscious. I don't do that. And certainly they were courteous to me, and they were kind. But those kids didn't part like the Red Sea when I walked down the hall. And I was accustomed to that, too. So it took me a while to adjust. I finished this degree last August, and I've been working since part-time as a counselor at Austin Community College. I need to go to work full-time just any old day now. So if you run out of things to pray about, and you need to fill your daily quota, you can put that. Some days I'm really scared about it. I have never been on my own financially before, ever. And it's high time, of course. You know, we don't have alimony in Texas, nor should we. There is no reason in the world for this man to support me who isn't living with me. But I get a little scared about that. And I have total faith that God has marvelous things in store for you. I believe it with all my heart. I have no doubts on your behalf at all. But I sometimes can't believe it for me. So I will believe it for you if you will believe it for me. I will hang on to your faith when my own gets a little shaky. Besides, you told me nearly 22 years ago that I would be all right. And I believe everything you've told me, because so far it's all been true. A few years ago, I was listening to a fifth step. And the man said to me, "When my wife was drinking, I was so obsessed with it that I missed the childhood of my daughters." He said, "I miss so many present moments that won't ever come again." And I like that term. Tommy Breen up in Winnipeg says, "The way you don't miss the present moment is to ask yourself, how am I conscious of God right now, this minute?" Well, I'm conscious of Him right now, this minute, because you did what I asked you to. You really did love me back while I was talking. And I thank you for that. And I thank you for being who you are and whose you are.